another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, where history proves that truth, or at least their version of it, is truly stranger than fiction. I have, in several podcasts in the past, mentioned the Church of God. And it's always interesting because I'm still researching. I'm nowhere near complete. There is just so much to untangle with Church of God. But anytime I mention it, I get a flurry of emails and comments. You've probably seen them, at least the comments side. And Church of God is interesting to me because, like Pentecostalism, it grew and split and grew and split. And when you say Church of God, you really have to clarify what Church of God you're talking about. Even in Wikipedia, if you type in Church of God, you'll see different names with parentheses. And that's because it grew and split and grew and split, which is a characteristic trait, I guess you would say, of the way Pentecostal has been influencing the churches. I'll just say it like that and try to keep it simple. So my research into the Church of God is nowhere near finalizing any form of opinion. And when I do mention Church of God, it's not that I'm against whichever branch of Church of God you're in, but where it gets really interesting is the splinter groups themselves. When you talk about one sect of Church of God, then you're talking about a group who is violently opposed to the other one. And so when I receive emails, I'll usually receive very highly critical feedback of specific areas of my research that is mentioned on the website or in the podcast. And then I'll receive a different email that you can clearly tell is from a different sect of Church of God that is fully supportive of those points, but takes the other points and fights the other guy. So it's almost like Church of God, different branches, are fighting each other in conversation, indirectly using me as the silent mediator. And I honestly, I really don't have a dog in the fight whatsoever. I've mentioned that a few times. Many of the groups that I investigate, I really don't have a dog in the fight. I really don't care. I'm just looking at milestones in history as this spiderweb of mess has developed from modern Pentecostalism into the New Apostolic Reformation. But there's so many spiderwebs of connections that make this possible. And if you choose to ignore one specific intersection point, the whole rest of it doesn't make sense. For those who are very highly against me talking about John Wimber and researching that intersection point, think what happens if you take that point out. If you take away John Wimber, do you really have the connection of the Kansas City Prophets to the UK? Do you really platform them? Does the Kansas City Prophets turn into the International House of Prayer in Kansas City? And can it influence the entire New Apostolic Reformation in the way that it did today? Not really. If you take away that point, that's a very critical point. Well, Church of God has similar points, but they're far back in history. They're not really modern points. And when I began my research, there's one thing that really drove me into digging into the Church of God. I was raised to believe, like many people who are in the New Apostolic Reformation have been trained to believe, that William Branham was a Baptist minister. And he had this experience from God. With that experience, he switched to a pseudo form of Pentecostalism and then went astray, is how they phrase it. And then it turned into a destructive cult, is what they're not saying. But that's not true. As I began to research William Branham and the history of the church, history of my grandfather's church, which was Branham's Branham Tabernacle, I came to know that it wasn't a Baptist church, and why would anybody lie about this? So I started digging into it. I found out that William Branham was a bishop in a newly formed Pentecostal sect called the Pentecostal Baptist Church of God, which was led by Roy E. Davis, his mentor. Roy E. Davis is the one who ordained him, and even in a letter to Gordon Lindsay, the founder of Christ for the Nations Institute, Roy Davis said that he is the one who ordained Branham and introduced him to the Pentecostal faith. So we have Davis's own words, which counter Branham's later words that were used as part of his stage persona. So I began to digging in this. I wanted to know why. For what reason would you want to cover up what church you were ordained in? So as I'm looking in Davis, number one, instantly I found all of the Klan-related stuff. He was the Imperial Wizard of the original Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. He was one of the founding members of the 1915 Ku Klux Klan. He helped write the bylaws, the Constitution, many other things. At least he claims this in the 50s. And so he was at minimum second in command to William Joseph Simmons, and that much you can kind of prove through the newspapers. Other key figures in Branham's ministry were also connected. Interestingly, William Branham's mentor, appeared to have been kicked out of several churches. He was first kicked out of the Baptist because he had multiple wives in multiple states. He was kicked out of a Pentecostal sect. I believe it was the Church of God. He was kicked out of that group because they had not only found out about his multiple wives in multiple states, but also he had this thing for young women. And I'll keep it simple and keep it at that, but you can read between the lines what's going on here. And not just one young female, it was multiple young females. So he got kicked out of a Pentecostal church, a Baptist church, a Church of God church, and he formed a religion, a denomination, of which he became the head, the general overseer. And this group was called the Pentecostal Baptist Church of God. So I began to research these. I wanted to know, well, if it's Pentecostal, if it's Baptist, Church of God, there must have been broader connections to this. And that's actually what led me into the Church of God research. Now, I'll admit, when I first published the Church of God research on my website, it was in its early stages. And I want to pause here to talk about that, because I think some people really don't understand what I'm doing and trying to do. With a page that I put on the website, it's the beginning of a research page. And honestly, it's the beginning of a conversation. I'll put the page out, people will contact me, they'll send me information I'm missing, they'll send me information I got wrong, and over time, this matures into a more active page that's more accurately described historically, but yet critical. And that's how all of my pages begin, whether it's John Wimber, William Branham, any of these. It starts out as an open door to a conversation. So you can look at a web page as though it's a living document. As I get new information that's critical enough to add to the document, I'll add it. And unfortunately, there's so many thousands of documents at this point, it's really hard to maintain them all. I'll probably need some help with this. But anyway, it's a living document. And I created a Church of God page, and I mentioned Roy Davis's connection to it. Now, when you do this and realize from the rest of my website the connection between Roy Davis and the Ku Klux Klan, this turns problematic to anybody who's in Church of God. They will immediately say, I can't tell you how many emails I got about A.J. Tomlinson trying to prove that he liked black people. Because they read the Roy Davis statement, they recognize the connection to the Klan, so therefore I must think that A.J. Tomlinson is not a person who likes black people. But that's not true. If you really know the history of the Klan, which not many people do, the Hollywood version of it just simply does not summarize their agenda. The Ku Klux Klan was actually established as a quote-unquote Christian organization. Think of it not as a Christian denomination, but think of it more as a Christian fraternal order. So people would join into this. They were joining into a fraternal order. They had the rites. They had the all of the different rituals, etc. But the agenda, they believed to be Christian, and they wanted it to be present in the Christian churches. If you go online, you'll actually find photographs of the white-robed people inside of churches, because that was the agenda. So they were touting themselves as a true Christian order, but also at the same time mixing Christianity with politics, making it a fraternal Christian order that is a blend of Christianity and politics. They wanted to change the government structure, and that's really the bottom line. They did not like certain aspects of the government and certain doctrine or certain laws that were being passed, and especially when you get into the 60s, whenever they wanted to keep the races separate. That was an agenda, but it wasn't just simply that. They were anti-Catholic. They were, I would say probably anti-Jew and anti-Black is the wrong word. They wanted more to be able to govern and control the Blacks and Jews. Because Roy Davis himself, he wasn't so much opposed to Black people per se. He did not want them to mix with the white race, and he did not want them to have any sort of governing structure over the church, etc. And that followed down through Branhamism. In Branhamism, we had Black people that went to the Branham Tabernacle who had no idea that this church was planted by the head of the Ku Klux Klan. So whenever I mention A.J. Tomlinson and I mention Roy Davis, it isn't anything at all to do with Black, which I wanted to describe that a little bit in this podcast. So for the sake of this podcast, there's a line that I want to trace that I don't think very many people connect, and that's A.J. Tomlinson of the Church of God, his theocratic church governance. Combine that with Roy Davis, who is, a, as I mentioned, part of the Klan, head of the Klan, but he's moving through fractured Pentecostal networks. And Homer Tomlinson, who is A.J. Tomlinson's son, eventually would go and try to push this dominion-style theocratic church government, so much so that he was branding himself as the king, and he wanted to become king of the United States. And there's some interesting articles. If you just type in Homer Tomlinson and search on Google, you're going to find all kinds of weird, weird stuff, right? The problem is, yes, he's connected to Church of God, but you will make people in Church of God fighting mad depending on which sect or branch of Church of God they're in. They'll brand him as an extremist. But I want to trace that theocratic government that is being pushed directly from A.J. Tomlinson, who helped organize the church, and I want to express my opinion, which is that when you have a church like this that is very, what's the word? It's very compatible with the Ku Klux Klan's agenda, which is why probably it attracted Roy Davis. Roy Davis wanted to allow the church government to overthrow what existing government was there. This would have been compatible with what he taught, so therefore he started moving through these networks. When you introduce that framework into your church where you're taking Christianity and blending it with politics, what you end up is not Christianity. Christianity mixed with anything else cannot be Christianity. It becomes something else entirely. So this is not just simply about one controversial preacher, whether I'm talking about Tomlinson or Davis or Homer. It's more about the religious system that can give controversial men access, legitimacy, and influence. And if you carry this forward into what we see today, New Apostolic Reformation, it's really the architecture that enabled what we see today. So, for me, the Church of God is a very critical milestone in this history, and it's one that's largely overlooked because historians make the mistake of trying to connect the dots theologically. This never works. You have to connect the dots architecturally, and by architecturally, I'm implying you have to look at what was their position in politics, what was their position in certain theology, but what was the, when you look at their theology versus the biblical core theology, and you see that there are some extra biblical ideas, what is the, how do they align in the variance between what they believe and what the Bible says? You'll find all kinds of spiderwebs of connections if you do this. And this is just simply one of the techniques that I use in my research. It's how I'm able to connect all of these ministries together. So I'm giving away all the secrets. You can do it too. All you have to do is just dig a little bit deeper than just the theology. So who was A.J. Tomlinson? I've mentioned him a few times in multiple podcasts and a few times in this one. I'm referring to Ambrose Jessup Tomlinson. He was one of the most influential Pentecostal leaders of his era. Through his role as the first general overseer of the Church of God, which was headquartered in Cleveland, Tennessee. And as you're probably aware, if you've studied anything to do with Pentecostalism, the Cleveland, Tennessee group has a little bit of infamy, and that's probably why there is so much debate whenever you talk critically about anything to do with Church of God. You have those that will say, no, we're in no way connected to Cleveland. And you've got the Cleveland branch who says, no way, those other guys have made us look bad. For me, again, I don't have a dog in the fight, but I'm interested in Tomlinson because under his leadership, the movement basically developed into a centralized form of church government, and it expanded from a small holiness fellowship, just a normal Pentecostal style group, into a very structured denomination with coordinated assemblies, publications, and missions. But what Tomlinson built was much more than just a denomination. He was not just simply organizing churches. Tomlinson was helping to build a centralized sacred authority structure. And it's really that structure that is appealing whenever you consider the broad scope of my research. The Church of God in Cleveland was shaped around the idea that leadership and the assembly reflected a restored New Testament order. So if you're thinking in terms of theocratic order, you have to have that theocratic order in order to be considered a New Testament church under that style, that mentality. So what this did was this gave the movement strength, missions, publications, etc., education, etc. And there's some interesting history there. I found, in fact, I'll put it on the screen if you're watching the YouTube version of this podcast, but I found one newspaper article which is talking about Roy Davis speaking in the Cleveland, Tennessee branch of the Church of God. So that would put him right here in the heart of what I'm discussing today. And for those of you who are on the video version of this podcast, I want you to pay close attention to the title line. It says, In Church of God Revival, Cleveland, Tennessee, November 21st. But pay close attention to, in parentheses, it says, it has the notation for special, SPL, period. This is significant because this overturns any claim that this was just a advertisement from that was presented by Roy Davis advertising his ministry in the local newspapers. This was a special report coming from Cleveland, Tennessee to this newspaper. And we know this is being reported from Cleveland, Tennessee because this particular newspaper, if you look at some of the other articles, such as Woman Injured as Auto Rams Auto, it is a report coming out of Cleveland, Tennessee. So this was a newspaper that was reporting events that were happening in Cleveland, Tennessee. This wasn't just some random advertisement. But at the same time, I find Roy Davis helping to establish a institution, a religious institution, for the Church of God. Now, it could be argued that that is a different branch of the Church of God, which is true. But if you understand that Davis is coming directly to Cleveland, Tennessee, right in the heart of this, it ties the branches more closely than I think people realize. So there's a point of time in history when, even though, yes, it had splintered and there were various orders of the Church of God, there were at least revivalists like Davis, which were communicating with multiple branches, and they weren't so divided as what it appears from the emails that I get. So you're talking about a movement that's growing in strength, but yet also was divided. So it had the opportunity through the divisions for somebody like Davis to come in. And basically, I don't know if he was trying to hijack the organization or what, but he saw it as a bedrock for which he could plant his ideology. That fact is evident in the very article that I put on the screen earlier. I'll throw it up again. In this article, it talks about all of the key points that I'm mentioning. Especially, he's being described as a lecturer for the Ku Klux Klan, right here in the Church of God revival advertisement. So Church of God, at that point in Cleveland, Tennessee, was so aligned with the Klan agenda that they're advertising he's a Klansman who's coming to speak here. But even that's not so important to me as two other things. Reverend Davis has been associated with the Reverend John Roach Straighten, which at this point in time in history is significant because Straton was a key figure in the Supreme Kingdom, which was an organization that spun off of the Klan, led by the Klan Supreme Religious Chaplain. And in that organization, they were basically describing the precursor to what in New Apostolic Reformation we would call the Seven Mountains Mandate. They wanted to take charge of the education system. They were unhappy with the government and wanted to change it. I think through this, they were also looking at media publications, trying to get embedded into the entertainment industry. It was basically the early stages for the Seven Mountains. So that connection is significant, but also it mentions that Davis is a person who is affiliated with the Fundamentalist Association. That is significant because Davis was a director, apparently, in the Fundamentalist Association, which links him directly to Gerald Burton Winrod. Winrod, who was pushing the fascist-type ideology into early fundamentalism, and who was preaching at Amy Semple McPherson's Foursquare Gospel Church. So there's so many different connections here that this is a very key intersection point in history. And again, I can't stress how significant that this one particular article is. You've got Church of God in Cleveland, Tennessee, who's advertising the Klan, advertising John Roach Straton, advertising the Fundamentalist Association. This is, if you're looking for smoking guns of how all of this connects, this is your smoking gun connection. So I guess I should probably pause here and talk about the core problem with this theocratic language. Because I know if you're listening and you're in one of these groups that is doing this, you're thinking, well, this, what's wrong with this? Why would we not want our church to help establish the laws of the country? Is not this a good thing? So just to pause and talk about some of these problems. Once a movement starts saying that our government is divinely ordered, then suddenly the disagreements in government, whether you're voting for one party or the next, it's more than just a voting issue. Now it turns into a spiritual issue. If you're voting for a specific government party or a government agenda and you say, this is divinely ordered, well, that by default means that the other party, the ones who aren't the party you're voting for, is satanically ordered. It can only be one or the other. So it's a very dividing strategy as it relates to politics with this core purpose. Remember, Davis, who he is and what he's connected to, this is exactly the thing that he wants. And it was so closely aligned to the Church of God that he's speaking in Cleveland, Tennessee. So when this happens, it starts to feel spiritual when you vote for your party. And you start to look at anybody who doesn't vote like you as though they're not spiritual. So it creates this, if you look at the framework of a cult, it creates this mental boundary between you and other Christians who aren't of your political mindset. And so the issue goes beyond Christianity. Is this fellow who's voting in a different way than you vote, is this fellow a Christian? Well, no, because he's not voting for my party. He must not be a Christian. Fast forward to today's New Apostolic Reformation, it has become so hypersensitive that now you have what I'm talking about here in history, now you have it on steroids. Everybody's so aggressively against the other party. And so when I look in history, this is an intersection point where this happened, but it's just one of many. It's not the Church of God was the root of the problem. That's just a problem with the theology. In that type of system, opposing leadership can be framed, I guess, as a resistance to God's order. So if you are leaning towards one political party, but your church is telling you that it's God's divine order that we vote for this other party, if you follow your instinct and vote for your party, you are resisting God's divine order. In other words, this is an anointed party. This is a party that's moving forward as part of Christianity. So what this does, if you go to the cult mindset, it suppresses the ability to critically think about why you're voting. I'm voting because I'm told to vote. I'm voting this direction because the church wants me to, not because I even agree with any of the positions, which you may agree, but The problem is you're being robbed of that freedom. So this is a system, this is a theocracy that really robs people of their freedoms. This came to a head in 1923. And whenever I talk about what happened, I think many people will relate to it and what we see today. Because in 1923, the Church of God was in an open crisis. And that crisis included control, church funds. Newspapers were starting to attack the group. They were starting to report that Tomlinson had appropriated about $14,000 of church funds. And for those of you who are good at math, $14,000 in 1923 is the equivalent to $266,000 in the year 2026. So we're not talking about any small sum of money. This was massive. And I want to pause here just a second because I've had multiple people from multiple podcasts, videos on the website, talking about this exact situation and saying Tomlinson is in the right. Tomlinson is in the right. I want to point out that from a legal standpoint, the court system can cover the civil liability and the criminal aspects of the case. They cannot cover the ethical. And so here we have Tomlinson, who, if you trace the history of the court system and court record further in the future, he is cleared of any civil liability and no criminal charges were filed. So from a civil and criminal standpoint, Tomlinson is okay. But think about the ethical, because that is where it really relates to my research with Roy Davis. Here you have two opposing factions. One person has moved $266,000 in today's money into a accounting system that doesn't even make sense. The court system kind of describes this if you trace that history. But you have another faction who's asking, hey, where's the money? Where's the money? And from an ethical standpoint, you can understand why that faction would be upset. We have a large sum of money that's gone missing, and your accounting doesn't really account for where it went. So from a ethical standpoint, you can understand why the other side would be angry about this. And this really was an open door for Roy Davis to come into the disarray. Tomlinson was eventually removed from his position. But after that, with this massive sum of money, now both sides of the schism that occurred, both sides declared that they were the real continuation. Because why would you not? This is a massive sum of money that we need to continue our church. And they fought really hard to keep it. So at that point in time, you really had no clear center. There were two revival bodies, which would eventually split, I believe, into more. And the claims of their legitimate history now were in question. And so when I get emails today, I realize that's the reason why I get it. There is no clear path all the way back to the original history. There's all of these schisms and splits over who knows what all. And so what this created was a problem for me historically. As I was trying to figure out all of this mess, and I'm talking about Roy Davis, who's coming to Cleveland, talking to the Church of God, speaking on behalf of the Klan, all of these other agendas that he had. The year that that took place was in 1927, and this came after the split. So what happened was, I got people from each side of the split claiming, no, he came to that other side, not ours. But here it says in plain text, it is Cleveland, Tennessee. But the key statement from the newspaper, as you can see clearly, it says it was a revival service that was held at the Church of God Tabernacle in Cleveland, Tennessee, which would have put it with the main body of the Church of God. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So I mentioned the timeline, which is significant. 1927, Roy Davis, who's William Branham's mentor, the former second in command of the Ku Klux Klan, the head of multiple fraternal orders, he is speaking at the Church of God Tabernacle in Cleveland, Tennessee, puts him right in the central hub of the Church of God. And this is happening after the 1923 schism. This is important and significant because of this. 1923, when the group fractured, think about how a fractured group can survive. The structure of it changes entirely. No longer is the authority, but the authority is harder to police. It's harder to say this person has credentials, this person is part of our main body. And you have Davis, who's kind of an outlier. He's working with the Church of God, but he's actually coming from a different part of Tennessee. He's coming in, and now he can come in and have a platform just instantly. And that's one of the problems with not having a solid set of boundaries around your doctrinal framework. People like Roy Davis can come in, and now he can strongly influence the group. Take that to today's world. You've got all of these various apostolic networks, which are a result of the same exact fracturing, but on steroids. The Pentecostal movement, the Church of God movement, all of these different Pentecostal organizations split into 1,000 splinter groups. They're almost too many to count, but they're all combined in this apostolic network under the framework of the New Apostolic Reformation. How do you police this? How do you say that this person from this group over here is not credentialed, he's not speaking the theology that we like or we even believe? How do you gatekeep this? Well, this was a problem that happened in 1927 because of the split that happened in 1923. So when you have this, just simply being visible can function like credentials. I'm Roy Davis. I'm famous because of, and it lists it right there in the newspaper article, I'm famous because of my affiliation with the fundamentalists, my affiliation with the Klan, my affiliation with John Roach Straighten. These become the credentials. It's not so much I'm a good fit for your group because of the doctrine. My doctrine is aligned with your doctrine. That's not what the newspaper article says. It's more about who he knows than what he believes. And that's the way that works when you have all of these types of schisms. It doesn't matter it doesn't really matter what you believe. As long as you can say and boast that you have a credential, then you can move forward. So, in other words, if you can get involved, you can look legitimate. And that's exactly what happened whenever Davis stepped in. This is the environment that he stepped into. Now, Davis did not come with a hidden past. I've mentioned in the podcast, you can go back through the Revival History series, which is now, if you want to listen to it on Spotify, it's now archived into a Revival History archive. You can go to the podcast page on the website and see where that lives. But if you look through the history of the Revival History that we've published, Davis's criminal, immoral, unethical past was not hidden from the public. He was an extremist, and it was very well documented, but also he was a criminal. He was a scoundrel. He was all of the above. There's very little good that you can say about the man. And this was the person who is embedding himself into the revival circuits of the Church of God, later influencing Branham, who would later influence the entire world through the Latter Rain revivals and post-World War II revival history. So Davis has an extreme past, an extreme background, but think about 1923. This is a time when the Klan had been largely exposed as a domestic terrorist organization. There was a New York World series of articles that came out that talked about how this group had invaded politics, had invaded churches, were running an anti-Semitic agenda, were so many different things. They were fully, fully exposed, which led to the downfall of that group and the rise of the Indiana Klan, And the Indiana Klan would grow to be the largest Klan organization in the United States history. And remember, Davis goes from here to Indiana. So there's some connections that I think people need to realize. But Davis did not come with a hidden past. He was coming into the Church of God at a time whenever Klan had immediate focus. And he's advertising in the Klan. So the fact that he advertised this in the Church of God revival and anyone showed up to the Church of God tabernacle, for me, that is very, very significant. I can't even stress how significant that was. Also, this came on the heels of a second white supremacy group that William Joseph Simmons, who founded the Ku Klux Klan, and Roy Davis as the royal ambassador pushed in Tennessee called the Knights of the Flaming Sword. So this was another domestic terrorist organization. Interestingly, that group got shut down because it was far more militant than the Ku Klux Klan. And that was shut down about, I want to say it was the year 1925 that it was shut down. So 2 years later, in Tennessee, you have the ambassador of the Knights of the Flaming Sword, which was widely recognized in Tennessee, who was working with William Joseph Simmons, who was part of the Klan, holding revivals here in the Church of God in Tennessee, Church of God Tabernacle. So this is very, very significant. And I think people need, if there's one thing that you take away from that, it's not that here's the Klan and here's a anti-black person who's coming to hold a revival. It's not that at all. They were pushing many of the same doctrines because of the idea we need to be more American and we need to throw out anybody in Washington who is quote-unquote un-American. We need to push out the Catholics because they're invading Protestantism. There's so many different agendas that this encompassed that it's not really a black or white issue. It's more of an ideological problem with domestic terrorism. There's no better way to say it. It's just such a complicated organization. And the takeaway is that this church was representing that complexity. And I think that's the key thing to understand. The other thing to understand is just simply the revival culture. Remember, this was a time when there wasn't a big, there was no televangelist. There wasn't a big radio ministry per se. Instead, you had these revivalists, these evangelists who were going from church to church, town to town. And they may or may not be aligned with the doctrine of the church that they're attending. So you can't even really say that the church was in agreement with the many things that Davis stood for, other than the fact they did advertise it in the newspapers. But talk about his theology. They may not have been fully aligned with his theology so much as they were his ideology. Whenever Davis is touring through the Church of God, he may go to this church, but then he may go to a Baptist church later. He may go to a just a normal Pentecostal church later, if you can use the word normal. There were so many different developing branches of Pentecostalism. But the key point is that one revivalist can go from one to the next, and think about how a revival works. So Davis goes, he preaches at a revival. It's usually not just him. He's preaching in tandem with other evangelists, other revivalists. Davis hears something that the other evangelist or revivalist says, and then he spreads it to another group. So as you go from group to group to group, you're picking up ideas while planting ideas. So when Davis makes that circuit, he's speaking in tandem with one guy. That one guy may have given him ideas, but Davis gave the other evangelist ideas. So then that other evangelist goes, oh, this is a brilliant idea. We should have these things from the Klan. And then he starts on his circuit. Now he goes and he spreads it from church to church to church. The problem with this revivalist type culture is that it is such a cross-pollination of ideas that there's no way to pinpoint where exactly a doctrine came from. You cannot pinpoint it because one person picked it up from another, picked it up from another, and they're all going in these circuits constantly. So revival culture was perfect for reinvention. And there, now take the Pentecostal element of speaking under the anointing. There are people in the Pentecostal movement, I believe this is the case with Church of God, but correct me if I'm wrong, you speak with the idea that God is speaking through you. Well, if you picked up the idea from the other guy, well, then the audience thinks that you got it from God. This is something new they've never heard. They don't know that you picked it up from the other guy in the other revival circuit. So the ideas of this theocratic governments, etc., this could come to be perceived by the crowds as though this was a divine interpretation of Scripture. And I think it was, because eventually this began to take hold. In that world, a man could rebuild religious credibility just simply by being seen in the right places and appear to the crowds as having been anointed by a new fresh word that he may have gotten from the other guy in the other revival. But the other key thing to understand here is that Davis was not just simply your average passing evangelist. They didn't just simply invite him because of the Klan or any of the things that they mentioned in the newspapers. Davis was a key figure, and he had somewhat credentials. I won't say credentials directly with the Church of God in Cleveland, but he did have credentials because in Knoxville, he was not just holding meetings. He was actually connected to the institutional planning of the Church of God, and this would have been the original Church of God. So if you're looking at all the different branches and names of Church of God, here's another one for you to research and look into, the original Church of God stream. In Dahlonega, Georgia, Davis claims that, well, the church, I should say, claims that Davis is part of their organizational structure, and they tied him directly to the Davis-McPherson Institute in Dahlonega, Georgia. So Davis is actually named in the religious institute, and this is a school of theology, basically. This is a group that's teaching Church of God theology. So when Davis goes to Cleveland, Tennessee at the Church of God Tabernacle, he is coming credentialed as having founded an institution for the original Church of God. So at this point in time, the schisms have happened, and apparently even some more schisms, but the Church of God Tabernacle was inviting a key speaker from the original Church of God stream, and this person was a significant figure in that stream. So that would tell me, that would link Davis directly to the Cleveland branch, because they're inviting somebody who's in a different part of the schism, right? And depending on which side of that schism you took, you either see this as a friend or foe. There's no better way to put it. One newspaper article, which I'll throw it up here on the screen, it identified Roy Davis as the president of that school. So now Roy Davis is not just simply visiting pulpits, he's actually involved in the organizational infrastructure of the Church of God. And why does this matter for Branhamism? In my Branham research, as I mentioned, Roy Davis he's a key figure. He is a bridge between the white supremacist ideology and the Pentecostal faith, all in Indiana, during an era whenever the Indiana Klan was exploding into the most massive Klan organization in the United States history. This matters for that bridge to Branhamism. And Roy Davis represents a historical intersection point where you're merging politics and revivalism, Pentecostal history, institutional Pentecostal history. This is a significant point in time. And Roy Davis comes to Louisville, Kentucky, I want to say either 1 or 2 years after this revival with Church of God. So according to the timeline, you've got Church of God splits 1924. Davis embeds himself in the Church of God during this time out in Dahlonega, Georgia. He sets up an institution. The Church of God Cleveland invites Davis back to Cleveland so that he can, I guess, influence them in the revival. Davis leaves to Nashville, Tennessee, where I can first place William Branham in a revival. I think it's 1928 or 1929. Davis is in the at the Parthenon in Nashville. William Branham mentions being in that revival and talks about Roy Davis drinking, I think it was strychnine or arsenic, some poison. So it places Davis with the snake-handling, poison-drinking sect of Pentecostalism. Then he moves to Louisville, Kentucky, sets up his church, his organization headquarters, and finally lands in Jeffersonville, Indiana, which would eventually be my grandfather's church, the Branham Tabernacle. Davis plants that sect. So according to the timeline, Church of God is a serious, serious milestone in history. So when you have all of that background knowledge, and you consider what I said earlier about Homer Tomlinson, and I know it sounded like a joke, this guy wants to be a king who's taking over the United States. When you really get down into the details of this, Homer Tomlinson actually is a significant figure in the broader scope of the movement. He actually took the logic much further. Homer Tomlinson inherited more than just the family name of Tomlinson. He actually inherited the theological imagination of creating and establishing a divine government system. And if you compare that to what's happening in the New Apostolic Reformation today, he doesn't seem that far-fetched. He's basically, he was mocked for doing what they're talking about doing in the New Apostolic Reformation. Because A.J. Tomlinson had already normalized the idea that sacred authority should have a visible institutional form. Roy Davis, who's working with John Roach Straton and others in this supreme kingdom sect, they were wanting to establish the second iteration of the kingdom of the United States, wherein the, in that case it was the Klan, but wherein these religious organizations, who the Klan touted themselves to be, would have authority over the government systems. So Church of God, the Church of God Tabernacle in Cleveland, is platforming Roy Davis, who has the same ideology that eventually was carried out into Homer Tomlinson's ministry. So Tomlinson basically just took that and pushed it further, but he took it out of the church order alone and entered into a political, theological type movement. He actually wanted to now take this to the next level. The sad part is, I look at the world today and I look at the New Apostolic Reformation, I can't see any other way in which they would establish what they're describing without doing what Homer Tomlinson did. Tomlinson, he basically took his theocratic party and said, I'm king of the world, and he used very open and honest language about it. So in my opinion, Homer Tomlinson, though he seems a little bit weird if you read the newspaper articles, he was actually more honest than any single one of the apostles in the New Apostolic Reformation, because none of them are telling you, how would you establish this theocratic order? He's given you the way it gets established, because there aren't too many other ways in which you could do what they're talking about doing. So Homer Tomlinson's theocratic party, if you want to look at it, it was the first failed attempt at what the New Apostolic Reformation is proposing that we do with the seven mountains. So you have to be really careful how you look at this. Homer Tomlinson was not the founder of seven mountains theology, but he was part of the ideological framework that enabled this type of ideology to exist. In other words, he was an important precedent for the same type of theology. This belief that divine rule should become visibly embedded in public power through politics, he was doing it exactly as it would play out if you attempted to actually do this. So that's why this matters. This dominion-style imagination that Pentecostalism, Charismatics, all of these different movements have adopted, it didn't just come out of nowhere. There are stages of history. There are intersections in history. Each one of those intersections matter, because imagine this. Take Roy Davis out of the equation. If he wasn't platformed in that revival style, would Homer Tomlinson have did what he did? I don't know. Maybe, because A.J. Tomlinson was kind of pushing the precursor of this idea, the foundation or bedrock of this idea. But I can't really say that it would have happened. We just don't know. What we do know is that there are these intersections where these extremist ideologies are entering into Christian theology. And again, if you take anything and blend it with Christianity, what you end up with is not Christianity. You end up with something that is impure. So that's really the way to look at it, and why this matters. The vocabulary has changed over time, but the idea behind the movement is much the same, no matter which intersection in time you look at. You know, previously, most of the congregation, if I understand the history correctly, they even did not vote because they thought politics were too rotten for Christians to dabble in. And much like the New Apostolic Reformation today, politics are evil, we're Christians, we're not politicians. And then eventually that turned into, we need to run and overthrow this thing. And that's kind of what he was doing. But he did it in a quote-unquote spiritual way, quoting Psalms or Proverbs 29, when the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. So he's using biblical terms, biblical scriptures and passages to try to blend politics with Christianity and establish this government style, which is basically he wanted to set up a theocracy in the United States, much like most of the New Apostolic Reformation. And at that point in time, we're talking 1950, and he was running, I think, for the 1952 office. At that point in time, according to the reports that I've read, the Church of God actually held a celebration with, quote, dancing and unrestrained singing and shouting in the Spirit. So we're talking 1950. This is long after the schisms. This is the son of Homer Tomlinson, who was a key integral part of early Pentecostalism through shaping the Church of God organization. The extremist version of this, one of the splinter groups, decides we're going to set up a theocracy, and the Church of God rejoices. So you can see how that the ideology is really the main focal point if you want to see how things progress over time. The theology is off to the side. It's the ideology that is pushing the movement forward. And obviously, we never had a king established in the United States. We never had a theocracy, but we did have people who attempted it. And not to pick on Church of God, again, I don't really have a dog in the fight of which schism is right and which one is wrong. Church of God is just one group in the long trail of succession and history of all of these intersections that I'm talking about in my research, where one group decided we're going to go and take over Washington. It's just one. There are quite a few of them if you look in history. All of that to say, it laid this bedrock, this foundation from which all of this was built upon, and eventually it could breed things like we see happening today, where they're actually in bed with politicians, and you can go see photographs where they're in the White House or they're in the National Prayer Breakfast, and then after the prayer breakfast, they're influencing politicians, congressmen, etc. You can read Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, and you can find some of that history. All of this is connected, more than people realize. But the point I wanted to make with this podcast is that not many people really trace those connections through the Church of God. And honestly, if not for Roy Davis's name of his organization, the very organization where William Branham was birthed as a quote-unquote prophet of the new revival, if not for the name of the organization, I never would have looked at Church of God. But Roy Davis called it the Pentecostal Baptist Church of God. And there was another key component to this. After I left the Branham cult, I had a friend who was, his father was a church planter for the Southern Baptist Church. And after our services, I wasn't in his father's organization or denomination, but after church, we would discuss some of the theologies that his father was teaching and that sect of the church was teaching, and it was identical point for point what I had whenever I was in Branhamism. The only difference was Branham was more extreme on those points. Where his church might teach modesty, our church taught the Pentecostal version of modesty. But doctrine for doctrine, if you take the prophet out of the mix, you had many of the same things. And at the time I was wondering, why is this? Because they're two separate denominations. Why are they so the same? And especially after I learned that Branham lied, it wasn't a Baptist church, it was a Pentecostal church. Well, now I started to look at Pentecostal organizations. Why are they so similar? And I began to realize it's not really the theology that is the train tracks that this thing moved upon. It was really the mixture of ideologies, politics, and Christianity. When you combine those, you've got this rail system that led you from places like Church of God, where Davis is holding his revivals all the way into the New Apostolic Reformation, where Davis's successor, William Branham, is spearheaded the entire post-World War II healing revival, and he's named as one of God's generals. So you can see how this thing has just shifted and morphed over time. One of those train tracks leading to today is the Church of God. So that's why I've been digging into it. I'm actually far from concluding that research. There's just so much more to understand and more to try to detangle, because it is a little bit complicated trying to even understand all of the different branches and what they believe and why they're different, etc. But hopefully this helps. Hopefully this something today can help understand the mess that we're in today. So if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.